I'm John Barrett Ingalls, and this is The How, The Why, presented by 1888. Every week, we connect with artists, authors, and innovators in the world of publishing and literature to discuss their creative process and creative purpose, and explore the evolution of the industry. 1888 serves as a regional catalyst for the preservation, presentation, and promotion of cultural heritage and literary arts. Let's get connected.
Hello and welcome to The How, The Why, brought to you by 1888. My name is John Barrett Ingalls, and today we are connected with Janine Van Gool, the editor and publisher and designer of Uppercase Magazine, the author of multiple books, including The Typewriter, The Graphic History of the Beloved Machine, which is showcasing some of the artwork at the 1888 Center currently through November 29th. Janine, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us and connect with us.
Thank you very much for having me on your show.
It is my pleasure. I love that sound of show. I'm just now starting after 3 years of, it's a show. I like that. Let's start. I would love to find out, everything that you're doing has this, like, design is obviously a through line through everything that you work on. And I'd love to find out where your fondness and connection to design and where that was born and where it came from and how you began to pursue that.
Okay, sure. Well, I'm a graphic designer by training, so I went to art college and studied design and illustration. But how I ended up there was just a love of books, starting way back into my childhood. As soon as I could pick up a pen, I loved just making my own little tiny books, and that was always something that was my primary focus was books. So it goes pretty far back. And so as I was growing up, I discovered that it wasn't necessarily just the topics of the books that I really liked, but it was the books themselves, like the physicality of the book and the feel of the paper and how many pages it had and the size, the dimensions of it all. I just really liked that. So when I discovered that graphic designers were in charge of making these books, then that's how I became a graphic designer.
And at what point were you like, I need to make a magazine that is all about design. I need to do this. Like, what was it that led to the creation of Uppercase?
Well, I'd been designing for clients for about 12 years or so, and a lot of them were arts and culture clients, so I had designed books for other people and designed a magazine for a client, for example. So I had been creatively challenged doing it for other people. And then around 2008 or so, the magazine that I had been working for finally folded. And they had been a very sporadic magazine. Like, one time there was 4 years between issues, so it was very off and on. But when they finally decided to call it quits, the magazine part of my brain was available. So I just thought, well, why don't I just make one for myself? Obviously, it was for a whole bunch of other people later on. But
right.
First, it was like, I'd like a magazine that speaks to what I'm interested in. So I just naively forged ahead.
Now let's talk about the process of, like, coming up with that first issue and what the magazine was going to contain and how you were able to curate and really develop what the grand scope of the magazine was going to be.
Sure. Well, the name Uppercase was originally the name of a gallery books and paper goods studio that I had in downtown Calgary. So it was a public space where the back was where I was doing design for clients, like that magazine I mentioned. And in the front, I had a gallery and a bookstore, and I sold greeting cards and things that I made. And I hoped someday that my own books would be on the shelves, but at the beginning, it was other people's publications. So I had gained a lot of experience creating, say, group shows of illustration, for example, and putting together more complicated projects that had a big visual component. So uppercase kind of developed from that eclectic stuff I was doing in the gallery, and I decided to turn that into this kind of a print project instead of just in the gallery. So that's sort of initially how it came about, was the curating of these shows, and I'm writing a blog at the time too, and just kind of becoming an editor and a curator and developing those skills.
How has it grown in its decade now of existence?
I've done 35 issues so far, and it's quarterly, so I guess we can do the math, but yeah. it keeps on going. When I first started, I really didn't think past, the first issue. I have to get the first issue done. And then, oh, great, I did that. And there's some people who subscribe, and I have to keep working. Okay, so I did the first year of issues. And then, oh, wait a minute, I have to renew people and get them to keep subscribing. And so the first few years was just kind of treading water and figuring out what it is to have a magazine and to run it and to nurture the readership. And now, these years later, it's more about kind of involving the community of readers that I have and highlighting them, and also, of course, making sure that the magazine is healthy. But I guess my role, I still do a lot of work. Like, it's just me, basically, and then my husband does customer service. But my role has changed a little bit from doing this for myself, and now I'm doing it for my community of readers.
At what point did you see books coming into play with uppercase? Was that pretty quickly?
My first publication as uppercase was actually a book.
Okay.
And it's a funny one. I don't know if you look back this far in my history, but my first book was called The Shatner Show, and it was about William Shatner.
I didn't find that. Oh, great. Tell me all about this.
You wouldn't even... You can't really see the threads of similarities to what I do now, but I did have that gallery and came up with this idea that a show about William Shatner would be pretty funny. And at the time, he was about to turn 76 years old, so I thought, oh, we have to have 76 illustrations about William Shatner and his various incarnations. So with that many illustrations, I thought that would be a terrific book. So that was the very first book we did, and we got Shatner's permission to use his face and be inspired by him, and had this really fun show of Shatner's, and it was a whole year of me thinking about William Shatner. So it was a funny thing to do, but I learned a lot about curating the show and working with all those illustrators, and really about promoting it too. We got some local and international press about it, and lots of people came to the gallery and kind of put us on the map there for a little while, and it definitely was a fun way to test the publishing waters.
When did you go into more of the design-centric? Let's talk a little bit about Encyclopedia of Inspiration and how that concept launched and is still growing with room for so many other volumes.
Yeah, so if publishing a quarterly magazine isn't enough work, I decided to start publishing an encyclopedia. And my interests over the years have really shifted towards, I love craft and vintage and the handmade. So this Encyclopedia of Inspiration is really aimed at people who also enjoy those pursuits. So the concept was basically I release these eclectic books. They're not alphabetical. They call it whimsical order, so whatever topics strike my fancy. And I committed to doing the first three books in the past year and a half. And the first one was Feed Sacks, which are vintage textiles that used to house flour and sugar and farm feed. And so my author, Lindsay Call McRae, wrote that one, and I did the visual research. And that one has a wealth of vintage surface patterns and really pretty pictures and things. So my readership really enjoys that sort of thing. And the second volume is called Stitchillo, and that one explores illustrators who enjoy using embroidery and stitching in their work, and then likewise textile artists who are telling stories through their stitching. And the third volume, which is just at the printer right now, is called Botanica, and that one is how florals and botany inspire creativity of all varieties. So the idea is that these eclectic topics are going to be released every so often, and you'll have this nice collection of books on your shelf to inspire you when you need a little bit of a creative pick-me-up.
Now, I'm curious, like, I feel like maybe the last 5 to 10 years, there has been this resurgence of, not maybe not even a resurgence, but just like a popularity through Etsy and Pinterest of this craft, of the vintage collections and curating and selling and reselling. And I'm sure that helps with everything that you're doing, but what do you attribute this new movement, so to speak, or interest or curiosity to really help fuel that marketplace?
Well, I think it's the most basic way is we're having a reaction to the technology that's in our lives. Hmm. We're trying to find a way to slow down and to reconnect with the handmade and with the process and slowing things down and things that are tactile and exist in a physical way, and it's not just some digital entity. So at least for me and my readers, that's where this kind of need for these things comes from. So I think it was just lucky that I was feeling that, you know, back in 2008, 2009 when I started the magazine, and now it's become more and more popular since I've kind of mature with the magazine. I guess other people are starting to like the same things that I've always loved, so that's been a good thing.
And obviously that's helped for your readership and subscriptions, and I'm
yeah,
assuming. Yeah.
No, that's been good. It's slow and steady as far as the growth goes, but that's fine. But yeah, definitely there is more and more appreciation for the handmade, and it is sort of a funny thing because in my case, the growth of the magazine and people know about the books because of technology. If it wasn't for Instagram and social media and, you know, sending out my newsletter and having a website, no one would really know about me because I'm a small publisher. But it's because we're connected so often online that people discover uppercase things and then hopefully spend some quality offline time with the things that I need.
Also, I'm fascinated. So you have these beautifully designed magazines, and you've taken up the mantle of creating fabric based on the magazine as well. Talk a little bit about that, and was it just something that, like, well, these are so gorgeous, I want to make things with them?
Well, thanks. Well, it was each issue of the magazine has a unique pattern that decorates the spine and the masthead. And so that was, I started way back in the first issue, and the patterns are a reflection or interpretation of what the content is on the inside of the magazine. So over the years, I had this nice archive of all these patterns. And then a few years ago, I had a surface pattern design issue that really focused on the industry of pattern making, so people who design patterns that are licensed to fabric company or licensed on products and such. And I featured 100 different artists in there. And this fabric company called Wyndham Fabrics really liked quite a few of the artists and commissioned them to do fabrics for their company. And so that was terrific. And I did a profile of one of the artists who had received this job with Wyndham Fabrics. And I got to know the people at Wyndham a little bit. And then maybe about a year after that, I kind of got up my nerve and I sent the president a photo of the spines of my magazine and said, hey, wouldn't this look nice as fabric? And he replied, yeah, let's do it. So it was the short story is that after about, I think, 6 or 7 years of designing patterns, I met the right people virtually, at least via email, and finally saw that that dream come true.
Are you surprised with anything these days as far as submissions and what people are sending you? Is there anything that's like, wow, I would never have thought this would have fit into our magazine, into what we're doing, but there it is?
Well, I guess I'm always surprised at how many submissions I get now. Hmm. You know, when I first started, I would get maybe 10, 15 submissions, and now I can get, well, for those surface pattern design issues, I think the record submissions I got was over 700 submissions.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
So generally, though, I'm talking maybe about 100, 150 submissions. So I'm just always surprised by that. And then it's such a wealth of inspiration for me to have the privilege to look at everyone's work in that way. It makes it hard to choose, though, because I have to whittle down, even if it's really fantastic work, because I only have so many pages to use. But yeah, I think the biggest surprise is just the sheer volume of things that I get to look at. And as far as really memorable submissions, there have been some that are just ones where people have really been personal about what they're submitting and been very honest and kind of raw with what they send me. And that's not always appropriate for publishing, but I really appreciate that people feel comfortable enough with sharing their submissions in that way.
Hmm. I know you have on your website kind of a guide. You have a link to your blog for a guideline for submissions, but maybe give a little brief of what it is that you look for. And are they issue specific or just thematic for the whole magazine?
There's two. So I have like just an open submission form. People can submit their portfolio, for example, if they're an illustrator or a craftsperson, they just want me to see what they're doing. And then occasionally I'll have a specific that's called open pitch, and I might list what the upcoming topics are that I'm exploring, and people can suggest articles or pitch themselves. And then for each issue, I have very specific themes or topics that I'm exploring, and those are open calls that are up for maybe a few weeks where people can submit to. And then it all comes to me, and then I look at every single thing. So. and as far as the guidelines go, the magazine is eclectic, but it is about creative life and things related to design and illustration and typography and handmade. So I don't publish poetry or fiction, and it's a very niche publication. So the first thing I would say to people who want to submit is just look at a few issues to get a sense of it before sending something in.
And are you open to book concepts as well in relation to design, and or is that kind of you seek out what you want to do for the books?
That's kind of a tough one because it's hard to say no, because what if there's that amazing idea out there
right.
that to do, but generally I have to admit that Uppercase is like pretty much a vanity press, because all these like the encyclopedias and the typewriter book, those are my own like personal passions that I've made into a book. So I really like coming up with the concept of the book and doing the research and getting the people involved and curating and stuff, so that's what I really like doing. So I have so many of those ideas, it's hard to imagine just receiving pitches from someone else and having the time to dedicate it to even more books as much as I'd like to. So I don't know if that answers it exactly.
No, sure, absolutely. And now I'd love to talk about your process and how you do put a book together. And I'd love to use the typewriter, the graphic history of the beloved machine, you know, especially since we're showcasing some of the vintage ads at 1888 right now at our gallery. But I'd love for you to, I know you've been collecting things over the years, but how do you go about finding and curating something for a book that size?
Sure. Well, the typewriter, this is like, I was obsessed with the typewriter. And that goes back many years. And when I did have that the gallery, I would have occasional typewriter sales, right? I'd collect machines locally or on eBay and fix them up and then sell them in my shop. And I just started collecting the things related to the typewriters. So as a graphic designer, I just really love seeing the little typewriter tins, for example, that used to house the ribbons, or the ads about typewriters, or the little, you know, the manuals and the typewriting manuals. So when I closed that, the gallery shop aspect, but I was still interested in collecting more typewriter things. So collecting those paper memorabilia and ephemera is, first of all, way cheaper than buying machines, and it also just doesn't take up as much room. So I let myself still be obsessed with typewriters, but limit it to kind of the paper stuff. And as I started collecting things over the course of a couple of years, I just realized that this is really interesting, and no one has ever put these particular things together before in a book. I know there's other books that are about the typewriter machine, or that are about, say, concrete poetry created with typewriters, but there wasn't a book that was about the, say, the graphic design aspect, the advertising, you know, sort of that visual culture aspect of the typewriter. So I decided that that was going to be my reason to collect things. I needed a reason to keep spending money on buying all these bits of paper and stuff. So my reasoning was that someday I'm going to make a book out of it. So the collecting actually ramped up a few notches once I decided I was going to make a book out of it, because then there was this kind of a mission to it all. I just kind of snowballed for a few years until the book was finished, and then I had to stop collecting because the book is done and there's no more room to add things.
Was there anything that surprised you throughout your collection and research?
Oh, well, just what women had to put up with, really.
Right.
So as secretaries, that's such a thankless job, really, and how they're depicted in advertising. You know, it's sort of funny to look at, but if you're immersed in looking at it for a while and really thinking about how that affected women's day-to-day lives and how they were treated as professional secretaries, is, you know, it's a bit of an eye-opener.
Well, it's amazing, too, how much of the advertising for such a long period of time was directed to not just women, but to secretaries in general. Mm-hmm. And like, even like thinking about it logically, like for the most part, I would assume the company would be providing the typewriter. So they're not even buying the machine themselves. They're just getting the job. But
yeah, certainly in the early years of the typewriter, the typewriter, the operator called the typewriter, would come with the machine. And then later on, the typewriter manufacturers would have schools where they would train people on the machine, and then they'd be available to hire out as well. But kind of in the heyday of the machine, secretaries were the main people using it. But the advertising was often directed at the women in women's magazines, to basically tell their boss which machines they wanted to be using,
right,
and that they could tell their boss, because you want this particular royal machine, you'll be faster and you'll make mistakes, and all these like reasons why that machine would be their kind of their best friend at work.
Yeah, and you know, I'm trying to, obviously, I have no direct relationship to that time, and I'm imagining that. You know, I was thinking, well, what about, like, you know, why is it just to the secretary when, you know, novelists and anything that was written, journalists were using their typewriters, but the majority of the purchase power probably did come from, you know, these huge office buildings filled with secretaries. So I mean, I guess it makes sense. It just seems so bizarre, you know, nowadays.
Yeah, well, there are some interesting ads to look at, say, around World War One, for example, where there's like a folding Corona that was advertised as for people who are, you know, in the thick of the action and they need to report on things. But that's sort of a rare take on advertising it. There's a lot of ads directed at families to purchase a typewriter for Christmas so that their children would be able to excel in school. And also a fair number of ads directed at college students who want to invest in a typewriter to do, you know, basically, if you have a typewriter, the ads will tell you, then you'll have better grades. Like, they have a direct equation there.
I have a about to be 9-year-old daughter, and she is fascinated with typewriters right now. Just loves the machine, loves the sound that it makes. So there may be a visit from the typewriter Santa Claus this year for her.
I highly recommend it, yes. And my son is 7, and he's grown up with machines, obviously, because I have quite a few, but it's just people can't resist the keys. They just want to press down those keys and type something. It's just this.
You're actually seeing, you're watching as you hit, it makes this arm raise up and press onto the ribbon. You know, it's like you see the direct correlation rather than the computer where it's just, here are the letters on my screen.
I definitely recommend getting one for kids. Last June, I think it was International Typewriter Day, I brought a typewriter to the school ground and had a crowd of kids coming around to look at it and to type something before school started. That was a fun thing to do.
I mean, I was in high school before the beginning of the internet, and so I had to learn how to type on a typewriter. I had to write my first papers on an electric typewriter. And I remember I liked the weight of the keys and I liked that experience, but I remember how, like, every mistake that you made and then making the copies of the, you know, I was so excited years later to finally have a computer. But now there is like a nostalgia to it. There's something that is permanent about the thing that you're writing on a typewriter. That it can't just be deleted. It can't just, you know, you have that one page and that's all there is.
Mm-hmm. Well, I tell the story in the typewriter book, but my first experience with a typewriter was going to, like, on a short day after school, I would go down to my mom's office, and she was an executive secretary. And so I would get to, you know, just fool around on a machine for a couple hours until it was time to go home. And that was my first experience basically becoming a publisher, where I could take the ideas that I had and type them out on a page and see these things become something physical. It was just really exciting to me that a machine could do that, that I could take my ideas and then reproduce them and hand them out to people. So,
aside from running a magazine and releasing a series of encyclopedias, what else are you working on right now?
that's pretty much it. That's enough.
Sure, of course.
Yeah, no, I as far as work goes, like, since the Botanica book is at the printer and it'll be released in October, so that I kind of fulfilled the first round of encyclopedias there. So right now I'm thinking about what are the next 3 topics that I'm going to do in that series. And I also want to do a little magazine that I've had in my head since my son was just a little wee guy, and now he's in grade 2. And that's called Little You, and it's the offspring of Uppercase Magazine, and it's creativity for the young at heart. So a bit of a cuter, smaller version of Uppercase Magazine. So I think that's going to be the next thing that I that I work on is making that little magazine, because I've basically had it in my imagination for about 5 years, and I think it's time to just make that one, exercise that one, and get it out of me.
I love it. And it's great to have that inspiration of your son there. Talk a little bit about how you organize your time to do all of this and to, you know, be a mother. Talk about how you find your routines in order to sit down and create and produce.
Yeah. Well, it's been a lot of practice. And I started the magazine just maybe a year before my son was born. So most of the magazine has been while I've been a mother. So I've learned how to balance those things. And in fact, having my son has just been a real motivator, because this magazine is publishing stuff that I do. That's what's supporting my family. So when I'm working, I make sure that I'm concentrating and getting the most out of that time, because it's important not only to fulfill my own creative needs, but also to create this business that's going to support my son and my husband. So I guess because of that, I'm pretty disciplined as far as using my time wisely when I'm in my studio. And that's an important part, is to have a place outside of the home to come and work so that I can really concentrate. And as far as organizing the things, I use Evernote, which is it's an app basically that it's on my computer and my phone and everything. And that's where I store all my ideas and notes and future things that I want to work on, and take pictures of things. And it's all in Evernote, and I sort it by tags and themes and such. And so that's how I can plan out my books and plan out the topics for future issues of the magazine and everything. So it's like my external brain. I've been using that since issue 2, so it's really kind of my catch-all for how I get everything done is through Evernote.
Nice little personal assistant there for you.
Yeah, it's been good.
Well, Janine, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me. And I urge everybody to go to uppercasemagazine.com and check out all of the amazing stuff that you're doing. I mean, even just scrolling through the website and watching the videos, it's visually stimulating, and it's inspiring as well. And if you're in the Orange County area, please come and check out the exhibit Typewriter, A Love Story, with some of the collections of vintage ads that Janine has found. Janine, thank you again.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed talking with you.
This has been The How, The Why with John Barrett Ingalls. The show is produced by Kevin Stanek and yours truly, with production assistance by Sarah Becker. The How, The Why theme music was composed and performed by Dan Record. Please consider supporting 1888 and our mission. Become an 1888 advocate by purchasing our books, participating in our programs, and pledging today. For more information, visit 1888.center. That's 1-888-DOT-CENTER. I want to remind you all to keep making art. Thank you.